Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capital Report.
Changes are in the works for Florida's kid care program, but supporters say the change will impact the entire family.
I'm not working the same hours. I'm not working in the same places. My life is disrupted and the life of my family is disrupted.
Also tonight, while it's drawing concern, some advocates are pushing for a measure aimed at helping sex abuse victims.
These women, when they were finally able to confront their alleged offender, wet their pants sitting in the courtroom because he was so frightening.
We'll also talk about end-of-life care, stricter regulation governing interpreters for the deaf, and hemp farming. I'm Tom Flanagan as we wrap up the fourth week of the 2016 Florida lawmaking session. This is Capital Report. The state legislature is on the verge of extending health care to thousands of Florida children. Nick Evans reports revisions to the Kid Care program will cover children of illegal immigrants.
There are few things less popular in the GOP than immigration reform. Past flirtations with the policy are being lobbed at presidential candidates, and Florida's lawmakers are pursuing measures clamping down on so-called sanctuary cities and discouraging Middle Eastern refugees.
This bill authorizes and enables the governor to protect Florida from those who would settle here with the intentions of committing acts of war. It identifies dangerous immigrants, defines as an invader anyone who enters with the intent of committing acts of war. It defines as a restricted person any refugee or immigrant intending to settle in Florida if they come from a location associated with invaders or prospective invaders.
That's Jacksonville Republican Representative Lake Ray. Critics say his proposal is unlikely to pass constitutional muster, but it speaks to an abiding wariness toward immigration within the GOP. Opposition has found root in fears related to employment, safety, and illicit drugs, but that's not to say Republicans lack empathy.
If these kids were anywhere else, in any of the states that have approved this language, they would be receiving care. But unfortunately, because of whatever reason, Florida has not been there, and we will be there with your support.
That's Representative Jose Diaz of Miami. He's spearheading an expansion of Florida's Kid Care program. It offers subsidized health coverage for kids who don't qualify for Medicaid. Under Diaz's bill, children of documented immigrants will be able to get coverage within the program immediately.
And the genesis of it is really it's really driven by the federal government. Through 2009, the population in question, which are lawfully residing citizens, kids that are here legally, would not be entitled to receive federal dollars like Medicaid until they were here for 5 years.
But it's been a long time coming. KidCare gets most of its funding through a federal plan called the Children's Health Insurance Program. It began in 1997, and like Diaz says, it mandated a 5-year waiting period before documented immigrants could take part in the program. In 2009, Congress passed an expansion allowing states to drop the waiting period, paying for new enrollees by increasing taxes on cigarettes and tobacco. Now, after years of trying, it appears Florida will join the 20-plus other states that have already removed their waiting periods. Vance Lupus from the Children's Movement of Florida says that's a pretty big deal for the state.
And I could have very easily waved in support, but I personally and publicly want to thank Representative Diaz for his tireless leadership on this bill. This bill will ensure that 17,000 children in this state who currently may not have a relationship with a pediatrician, may be using emergency rooms as their primary care, are covered.
And those emergency room visits are important. Diaz says the decline in expenditures devoted to emergency care will offset the state's contribution to kid care. Port Orange Republican Fred Costello commends Diaz for his attention to the balance sheet.
But I guess I have to make one comment. I supported this back when it had a fiscal impact because we got to take care of the kids. I can't imagine going from $500 million down to almost nothing. You did an amazing job. Thanks for everything you did to make this happen.
Here's Diaz again.
Something I've mentioned in the previous committees is that one of the reasons this bill is so important to me is because, you know, I am the child of immigrants and people that came to this country for all the right reasons and went about the process the right way.
Diaz's measure doesn't expand coverage to undocumented immigrants. The proposal made it to the floor of both chambers without a no vote in committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
A bill allowing all sexual abuse victims to avoid going physically to court to give their testimony during a trial has passed its first Senate panel. But as Sasha Cordner reports, not without some concerns.
Jennifer Dritt is the executive director of the Florida Council Against Sexual Violence. She says as a social worker, she often deals with cases where victims are afraid to face their alleged offender in court.
Thinking of a case in particular that I know personally, in which a serial rapist abducted women, battered them, raped them, and then forced them to walk the streets as if they were prostituted. These women, when they were finally able to confront their alleged offender, wet their pants sitting in the courtroom because he was so frightening.
That's why Fort Myers Republican Senator Elizabeth Beniquisto says her bill is needed. It's an expansion of a law already in place that applies to victims under the age of 16 or who have an intellectual disability.
Currently, we allow minors who have been abused the right to face their accuser via video rather than in open court because of the emotions it can trigger. This bill would offer sexual battery victims who are older than 16 years of age the same courtroom safeguards that are statutorily available to younger victims. The bill provides a framework by which the presiding judge in the sexual battery case can consider and weigh the likelihood that the sexual battery victim would suffer at least moderate emotional or mental harm due to the presence of the defendant if he or she is required to testify in open court, while also protecting the defendant's constitutional right to confront his accusers.
But the bill drew multiple questions as well as concerns. Lakewood Democrat Jeff Clements questioned how that process would work.
Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I know this is always a very sensitive and difficult subject. The last thing you said there about protecting the constitutional right to be able to confront your accuser. Can you talk about how that works within this framework?
Beniquisto says it would work the same way it currently does for minors.
The defendant's attorney can cross-examine the victim, but it would happen via closed-circuit TV or behind a two-way mirror so that the defendant has the right to have the questions asked in order to prove their innocence, but the victim can have the protection of doing it without facing that person literally in a courtroom.
The Florida Public Defenders Association is against the measure. Columbia County Public Defender Blair Payne, who represents the group, says their first concern is the bill assumes that there's a victim. He adds he also has a problem with leaving it to the judge's discretion to weigh whether the victim is suffering at least, quote, moderate emotional or mental harm.
That's not defined. And I would suggest to the committee that that term will be defined or could very well be defined one way in Pensacola and a totally different way in Miami. In where I grew up in the country in North Florida, you know, everybody's got the crazy uncle that you sit on the front porch, and we don't consider him mentally impaired. But you take that same person to Tampa, and they may say, you know, he has a significant mental impairment.
Payne says public defenders also feel the bill infringes on the defendant's right to confront their accuser. He says trials are normally fluid, and juries can make determinations based on the alleged victim's demeanor as they're cross-examined in the courtroom.
We're taking away a jury's right to see the witness when it is being actually confronted. And I got to ask a question about this earlier. Well, you're entitled to cross-examine the witness, and maybe it's by videotape before trial. And that's true, but that's not true confrontation.
But Jennifer Dritt with the Florida Council Against Sexual Violence disagrees.
You know, this bill, as I understand it, doesn't prevent a court from allowing the jury to view the testimony through video link. I think it's possible, and this is a good bill, that will protect both alleged victims and the rights of alleged offenders.
Still, St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis had some concerns. He outlined a sexual abuse victim scenario versus someone who was an attempted murder victim.
We're giving a special right to someone because of the sexual abuse situation, but simply if he had pulled out a gun and almost shot her, I mean, almost killed this woman, she wouldn't have that right. Can you help me understand why you think that there's a special place for this scenario, but not for the attempted murder scenario?
Certainly.
Andrit says after working years with abuse survivors, she does see the two a bit differently.
Most people who are, in my experience, are victims of attempted murder do not face the sort of relentless failure to be believed, which is already difficult for them. And while murder is, an attempted murder is clearly a horrible crime, it's personal in a very different way. So what we're, the crime of sexual violence is traumatizing in a very personal way that's, and is deeply disturbing to the survivors of that assault in a way that affects their confidence over their lifetime, in addition to typically blaming themselves for the sexual assault.
Some lawmakers also suggested the measure should include better guidelines for the judicial discretion, but despite those reservations, the Senate Criminal Justice Committee unanimously passed the measure. Meanwhile, its House companion has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida lawmakers have a tough conversation about end-of-life care, but some view it as the first step toward euthanasia in Florida.
Are you signing your life away? That is the real question people need to ask when they approach a post.
Are prison-based businesses an unfair competitor with the private sector? Some in the Florida legislature think so.
Serious concerns over the last number of years have been raised concerning improper use of state assets, competition with the private sector, exorbitant salaries, whether skills taught are transferable, number of inmates in the program, transparency, and financial management.
Much to the surprise of many people, including some state lawmakers, Florida doesn't demand much in the way of formal qualifications when it comes to those who interpret for the deaf.
Florida is one of only five states that has no standard for sign language interpreter qualifications in K-12 programs.
And shades of President Washington and Jefferson. Lawmakers are considering a study of hemp farming in Florida.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth and productivity of Florida depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust encourages all businesses to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital staff members. More information is at abletrust.org.
One Florida lawmaker's efforts to provide clear guidance for end-of-life care turned into a conversation on death and euthanasia. Lynn Hatter reports Republican Senator Jeff Brandt's bill would lead to the creation of a portable form patients and their doctors fill out to make sure the patient's wishes are followed.
One of the hardest conversations to have is what to do when a loved one is dying. But Republican Representative Jeff Brandt believes it's a conversation that must be had. Both of Brandt's grandparents died in the past 2 years.
And it's come to just my belief that we've got to find a better way in Florida for people to pass and to have that conversation happen earlier than standing outside the door of the hospital room wondering, what do we do next?
Brandt is putting forward Senate Bill 664, which would establish a POLST form in Florida. The POLST, spelled P-O-L-S-T, refers to a physician order for life-sustaining treatment. Such a form goes beyond a written order of do not resuscitate or DNR and even transcends a living will. The POLST is transferable between doctors and facilities that treat a patient, and it's written between the doctor and the patient who map out what the course of treatment will be. But it's also disputed by some who say it's the first step toward euthanasia in Florida.
Are you signing your life away? That is the real question people need to ask when they approach a POLST.
That's Diane Gowski with the Florida Catholic Medical Association. Meanwhile, Tallahassee family law attorney Teresa Ward warns the bill could eventually expand to let others make crucial medical decisions.
This is a convenience for the institutions, for hospice, for the hospital, to let us go easier. It is a step toward euthanasia, and it will be amended to make it easier so that someone else for you, mercifully, it will be said, can check those boxes for you.
The bill has a one-year expiration date, and it would apply to terminally ill patients, largely regardless of age. But some say the expiration date should be removed completely. The measure is supported by the Florida Catholic Conference and Tallahassee-based physician Ken Brummel-Smith, who also serves on the state POLST task force.
You may know that advance directives are very important as expressions of future wishes, but in reality, patients with advance directives only receive the care that they want 50% of the time or less. Studies have shown, including research that I've done myself, that with Pulse, patients can receive as much as 86 to 94% of all of the treatments that they want and not receive treatments that they don't want.
So many people are in denial about death, and it's not if, it's when, because we're all going. And so the discussion is time now.
Democratic Senator Arthena Joyner of Tampa says she's backing the bill, and Senator Jeff Brandis believes it will help eliminate uncertainty.
Would you like more quality towards the end, or do you want more quantity to the end? At the end, it's a very important discussion to have discussions about what your goals should be like at the end of your life.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
At a time when Governor Rick Scott is begging businesses to come to Florida, some lawmakers want to shut down a $70 million a year Florida-based corporation that cranks out everything from custom office furniture to false teeth. As Jim Ash reports, the fight is over inmate work programs, and the battle's getting heated.
The legislature created Pride Enterprises in 1981 to busy idle hands and give inmates marketable skills for life on the outside. Private industry has been complaining about unfair competition ever since. And House Judiciary Chairman Charles McBurney of Jacksonville is listening. Here he is unloading on Pride in the Criminal Justice Subcommittee earlier this week.
We had member after member after member who came to me and said, there are problems in my district because of what Pride is doing, whether it's taking monies off the tax rolls, whether it's competing against private industries, whether it's complaints about exorbitant salaries, and so forth.
McBurney's bill would get rid of the nonprofit corporation and put the Department of Corrections in charge of inmate work programs. A seven-member appointed board that includes private industry would oversee everything. It would be a big job. In 2014, Pride trained nearly 4,000 inmates in 41 programs at 29 prisons. Pride runs dental and vision labs, manufactures park benches and office furniture, and is involved in cattle ranching and sugar growing. Pride lobbyist and general counsel Wilbur Bruton reminded committee members that Pride gets no state funding, and he insisted its programs are working.
We have a 10.1% recidivism rate. Our starting wages is over $10, and such for every inmate that leaves. 78% of all of our participants get full-time jobs when they leave.
A staff analysis mentions audits in 2003 that accused the Pride Board of poor bookkeeping and overpaying managers. The analysis says Pride, quote, has had historical problems with transparency and financial management. Bruton says the problems have long been fixed. McBurney declined to be interviewed for this story, and it's not clear why he's targeting Pride now. Here's what he told the committee.
Serious concerns over the last number of years have been raised concerning improper use of state assets, competition with the private sector, exorbitant salaries, whether skills taught are transferable, number of inmates in the program, transparency, and financial management.
The Florida Smart Justice Alliance is on the record supporting the bill, but it's not unusual for the group, which is backed by the conservative Associated Industries of Florida, to side with Republican leadership. McBurney's complaint that Pride slots are going to the wrong inmates is an old one. Former Department of Corrections Secretary Jim McDonough says he resigned from Pride's board in frustration in the late 2000s after failing to be able to fix the problem.
I actually discovered that we had some people working in jobs that were never getting out of prison. They went for life. But they had good skills, and Pride wanted to make use of those skills.
McDonough says Pride management objected when he tried to remove lifers from the program. Bruton says Pride has to take the workers the department gives it. The staff analysis notes Pride doesn't have to pay unemployment compensation for its workers, and that it enjoys the same protections from lawsuits that governments do. The concept is called sovereign immunity. The analysis also cites state laws that require state purchasing officers to buy from Pride if the products are, quote, similar in quality to private competitors. But Bruton says government purchasing managers still have and often use broad discretion to pick private competitors.
Point being that nobody's mandating anybody to do anything.
McBurney's bill cleared the committee with only a single negative vote, but its fate is still far from certain. A Senate companion has yet to move. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Some state lawmakers want stronger qualifications for interpreters working with the deaf and hard of hearing. Kate Payne has that story.
There's a bill moving through the legislature that would update the qualification process for educational interpreters. That's because currently neither the state nor the Board of Ed has established criteria. Representative Lori Berman of Boynton Beach says it's time to change that.
Florida is one of only five states that has no standard for sign language interpreter qualifications in K-12 programs.
American Sign Language, or ASL, is the primary mode of communication for deaf and hard of hearing people in the U.S. Most every feature of spoken language is also present in sign language. So ASL has its own grammar, syntax, and slang, as well as accents and regional dialects. Christine Sun Lee is a deaf artist, and she gave a TED Talk comparing ASL to music. Here she is speaking through an interpreter.
If you assign a different parameter to each finger as you play the piano, such as facial expression, body movement, speed, hand shape, and so on as you play the piano, English is a linear language, as if one key is being pressed at a time. However, ASL is more like a chord.
When it comes to interpreting ASL, there is more to it than simply knowing the signs. Interpreters must receive and express messages in two different languages in real time. A good interpreter conveys not only the words of another person, but the spirit behind those words. June McMahon represents the Florida Association of the Deaf, and she says interpreters play a vital role. Here she is speaking through an interpreter.
We really need our deaf and hard of hearing children to be able to learn on par with their hearing counterparts. And if you put them in a classroom with somebody without appropriate interpreting skills, that's just not going to happen.
The need for qualified interpreters in public schools isn't a new one. Over the past 25 years, many deaf and hard of hearing students are moving away from specialized schools and into neighborhood public schools. June McMahon says some schools aren't keeping up.
And I've seen literally somebody who's taken two sign language classes apply for the job as an interpreter. And the administrators in the school don't know sign language and they don't have a clue. And they say, oh, you took two classes, you knew sign language. Oh, great, you know sign language.
As people move between deaf and hearing culture, there are miscommunications. Ironically, this disconnect was made abundantly clear when Representative Berman presented her bill to the House Ed Appropriations Committee. Members of the deaf community came to testify in support of the bill, but because of a scheduling issue, the committee didn't provide any interpreters to speak for them. Greg Leifers is a lobbyist for deaf rights.
But this meeting was not agendized until Friday night. And the rules on Online Sunshine say you must have a confirmed meeting set up before you can get an accommodation. So Morgan made a request for an accommodation on Monday morning, and there are no interpreters around that can come. So she's without an interpreter.
Fortunately, there was an interpreter in the audience who was able to speak for Morgan Eastman. Eastman says she excelled in Leon County Public Schools until her qualified interpreter got sick.
There was an important test coming up, and my interpreter became ill, and somebody else had to substitute for her, and that person was not qualified. That week, I was struggling to learn the material for that was going to be on the test, and then we went ahead and took the test, and when I got my results, I got an F on the test. I was really upset. I felt cheated. My education had been cheated.
Ultimately, the committee passed the bill unanimously. The bill has one more stop before heading to the House floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, a measure in the House would pave the way for hemp farming in Florida, as we hear from Regan McCarthy.
In the U.S., when people think hemp farmers, they often think marijuana growers. But Tallahassee Democratic Representative Michelle Raywinkle-Vasalinda says marijuana's low THC cousin, hemp, has a long list of non-euphoric uses.
I mean, it can be used for clothing and paper and all kinds of things.
And Raywinkle-Vasalinda says the crop has a long history in the United States.
But we need to get back to some of the old ways. You know, this session and in sessions before, we've worked on technology. We've worked on moving social issues forward. But you know what? Sometimes the old ways are the best ways. And George Washington grew this plant. So did Thomas Jefferson. And there's so much that can be done.
And Titusville Republican Representative Tom Goodson points out officials encouraged farmers to grow the plant during World War II so it could be used to create rope and other materials for the country's armed forces. But since then, hemp has been lumped in with other forms of cannabis as a Schedule I controlled substance, prohibiting hemp farming in most cases. But Ray Winkle-Vasalinda says she has a bill to help the state get around that.
So what this bill does is very simply take a miraculous plant that Americans have grown for years and allow it to be studied by FAMU so that we can grow it again.
Federal law makes allowances for hemp farming under certain circumstances, one of which is research at a university. Ray Winkle-Vasalinda's bill would create a path to establish research programs at Florida A&M University, as well as the University of Florida. And industry experts say they're excited for the plan, but they hope the state will encourage the schools to develop a close working relationship with industry experts. Robert Clayton represents the group Florida Hemp Processing.
We do need industry support here. You know, the charter of a university is to partner with industry, because you go to school so you get a job, and if they don't keep their programs in line with what industry wants, they're going to come out making buggy whips and when the world ain't buying them.
Meanwhile, Plantation Democratic Representative Katie Edwards says it's clear to her hemp farming could be a positive thing for the state.
Looking at it in its basic form as an agricultural commodity, I think that the benefit it provides, we have heard about industries are being decimated by things like greening and canker. So to give our farmers additional outlets to grow a cash crop that could be used as textiles, clothing, pharmaceuticals is very exciting. And I think its day has come, and I hope that the bill passes this year and hemp becomes an additional cash crop for our Florida farmers.
Ray Winkle-Vasalinda has pushed similar legislation for several years. Last year, her measure never got heard, and while it's made it through its first committee stop this year, it has several more to go. Meanwhile, a similar bill in the Senate, which passed several committees last year, hasn't had a hearing this session. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Ronald J. Evan, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.